63. They moved back into the corridor, slipping around the corner that led to the motor pool, keeping out of sight. In front was a neat row of open-topped jeeps, along with the two guards she'd already noticed. Beyond the helicopter, resting on its elevator platform, she could make out two other guards, rifles slung over their shoulders. She could also see a couple of mechanics working behind one jeep and a person in an officer's uniform speaking to one of the guards. They might not be on full alert, but they would wake up fast. Corey felt the sweat beading on her brow. Maybe Watts was right. This was suicide. Even though they had the advantage of surprise, they were up against trained professionals. Not only that, but they were outnumbered, with limited ammunition, and the moment they started shooting, it would be like ringing the dinner bell for the whole... Her thoughts were interrupted by Watts, who had slipped up beside her and braced himself in a shooting stance. The time for thinking was over. She followed suit, then they raised their weapons simultaneously.
"On three," Watts whispered. "One, two, three."
They both stood up and opened fire. Watts got off four shots in rapid succession, immediately dropping three guards. Corey concentrated her fire on the officer, scoring a hit and sending him sprawling. With a blood-curdling yell, they charged in, Corey and Watts flanking Skip. Corey continued firing in the steady, measured way she'd been taught in countless live fire exercises at Quantico. Everyone in the motor pool who wasn't shot had immediately taken cover. In the brief moment before the soldiers returned fire, Corey and Watts sprinted toward the closest vehicle while Skip tossed Molotov cocktails at the helicopter. There was the sound of shattering glass, followed by a whoosh. Blue flames spread like spilled flambé across the floor around the chopper, flames licking up its sides, causing instant panic. They reached the jeep, and Corey, being closest, leapt into the driver's seat, relieved beyond measure to see a key in the ignition. She turned it as Watts landed in the passenger seat. A burst of gunfire raked the vehicle, smacking the glass and hammering the armored sides, and they ducked, keeping their heads below the level of the glass. More soldiers were appearing from beyond the chopper, temporarily held back by the flames. Head still down, Corey threw the vehicle into reverse and pressed the accelerator. It shot backward with a squeal of tires. She angled towards Skip, who was lobbing his last Molotov, and jammed on the brakes, the gunfire deafening in the enclosed space, hammering the sides of the jeep. Skip vaulted into the back, and Corey floored it, tires screaming, the rear of the jeep fishtailing as more gunfire pounded the armored sides. She accelerated out of the motor pool toward the long hallway, back in the direction they'd come.
"Whoa! Shit!"
Watts yelled as they veered into the corridor. Corey braking hard, sliding into the wall with a heavy smack, the vehicle bouncing and swerving. Trying not to think of all the soldiers she'd seen boiling into the motor pool, Corey concentrated on her time at the high-performance driving track at Quantico, turning into the skid and recovering. Ahead of them, far down the corridor, soldiers were hastily assembling, blocking the way and aiming their weapons. She had no choice but to go straight at them. Gunning the engine, Corey shot down the hall as rounds struck the front windshield, turning it into a web of cracks, not penetrating, but making it impossible to see through. Corey was forced to raise her head, exposing herself. The gunfire was deafening in the enclosed hallway, and she could feel the snap of rounds passing her head, once heard, never forgotten. Some soldiers were firing low, but so far, the jeep's bulletproof tires were taking the punishment.
"Ah!"
Corey screamed as the vehicle closed in, the shooters leaping to either side as it tore through, hitting one and flinging him up against the wall. She kept her foot pressed on the accelerator. A moment later, fire began pouring upon them from the rear, once again stopped by the glass.
"Toth is just ahead!" Skip shouted.
Corey raced onward, glancing off one wall and almost losing control, then slowing, sliding over the slick concrete floor, bouncing once again off the wall before fishtailing back on track.
"Here!"
Skip yelled. They rammed through the double doors into the medical lobby, screeching to a halt at Toth's door. The corridor here was narrow, and Corey could barely keep the jeep from sliding into an unrecoverable wedge between two walls. Watts jumped out and rushed into the room, cut the bed rail handcuffs with a few well-placed shots, and appeared a moment later carrying the engineer. He dumped her unceremoniously in the shotgun seat while she yelled in pain, then vaulted into the back himself.
"Now we get my sister," Skip yelled. "Where were they taken?"
"Through the doors, then right," Toth gasped.
Corey bashed back out the set of doors and roared down the wide corridor, following Toth's directions. But as she sheared the vehicle around a dogleg, they came face to face with a near phalanx of soldiers. The squad lowered their weapons and then, with the bark of an order, unleashed a withering barrage, so intense it finally penetrated the windscreen, shredding it and sending bits of glass like gravel everywhere. This had to be the end. 64.
"And you, Nora?"
Rush asked, turning his gaze to her. Nora returned it. She wondered if Tappan was sincere or just playing for time. She needed to know.
"I'm not on board." "That is truly unfortunate. Your partner seems to have grasped the situation. I'm surprised you haven't done the same."
He turned to one of the soldiers.
"Take her back to the cell."
"Wait," said Tappan. "Nora, look at that thing. Think about what it just did."
"What about what we did?"
She gestured toward the graphite box.
"We found that thing. It didn't kill us."
"This is a waste of time," said Rush. "Either you're with us, Dr. Kelly, or you're not. And the longer you dither, the less inclined I am to trust you."
"She just needs more time," Tappan told him. "You're asking us to absorb all this too fast. If I'm going to join you, put my billions to work on this project, I can't make such a huge leap alone. I'm going to need her with me."
He turned to her.
"Nora, you've got to think this through."
"I want to see what's in the box,"
she replied, doing her best not to glance toward the soldier's position.
"What we found, but never got a chance to see."
"What's in the box is irrelevant to your decision," said Rush.
"What's its purpose?"
"How can we possibly know that?"
Rush asked, exasperated.
"Bring it to me," Nora said. "I need to see it. I want to decide for myself if it's truly hostile."
"That's a distraction, a sideshow."
"Open the box," said Tappan, "or I'm out too."
After an agonizing silence, Rush gestured to the two soldiers to bring the box. They carried it over and placed it on the floor.
"Open it," Rush ordered.
One soldier bent down, unlocked the box, and raised the lid. For a moment, Nora hesitated. Then she stepped forward and peered in. Inside was a cube, about 2 inches on a side. It appeared to be floating just above the bottom of the box, with no obvious means of support. Then again, she wasn't sure. Its edges were blurry. And now, inside the cube, she could make out a sphere from which greenish light ebbed and flowed like water, creating curlicues and eddies. As she watched, the sphere inside the cube began to rotate. Slowly at first, then faster and faster as the glow brightened, its hue changing to chartreuse, then to an indescribable, otherworldly yellow. She abruptly knelt and reached gently into the box.
"What are you doing?" Rush cried. "Are you insane? That thing might kill you at any second."
But Nora, in an almost mystical, transcendent state, cupped her hands beneath the cube. Her years of disbelief and academic dismissiveness had, in the face of all she'd seen, given way to something else entirely, something almost completely the opposite. She tried to grasp the cube, but it rose along with her hands, always hovering a few inches above them.
"Shut the box,"
Rush ordered the soldiers. But as she lifted her hands, raising them and the alien artifact above the confines of the box, the cube abruptly flew upward,
expelling a coruscation of colors like glittering chaff, and then shot toward the probe. As it did, the oval whirlpool in the hull, the damaged area, a tiny storm in an otherwise placid surface, abruptly opened wider, and the cube darted into it. Instantly, the whole iris shut, then vanished into a swirling pool of color.
"Son of a bitch!" Rush cried, backing up. "What have you done?"
Ducking below the dash again, Corey stamped blindly on the pedal. The shouts and cries of her companions, the noise of automatic rounds pounding against the vehicle, were deafening. The last of the bulletproof glass shredded under the onslaught. She kept the pedal pressed down hard, unable to see where she was going, but keeping the wheel as straight as she could, until she suddenly felt a sickening smack. A moment later, the body of a soldier bounced and rolled over their vehicle from front to back in a geyser of blood. Thinking fast, Watts grabbed the man's weapon and Skip propelled the body off the rear. But the impact caused the Jeep to stall, and the soldiers rushed them as Corey frantically worked the starter. Watts popped up from the back seat and let fly a spray of automatic gunfire just as the engine again rumbled into life. Rising above the dashboard, Corey jammed down the accelerator with a fresh squeal of rubber, the remaining soldiers running in hot pursuit. They hit a T-intersection, caroming off the far wall. At the far end of this new corridor was another intersection, and at its center, Corey could see a metal door, rolled wide open. Beyond was a huge vault, its walls covered with electronics. And in the center lay a bizarre object. Standing in front were Tappan, Nora, and a man in uniform, flanked by two soldiers. As she accelerated down the corridor, she saw a flash of green, followed by a brilliant streak of light. The object lit up in an intense and crazy swirl of colors, followed by a deep bass note that rattled her teeth and shook the subterranean foundations of the base itself. The Jeep sped down the hall, closing in on the hangar. Nora was transfixed by the sight. The deep note that sounded upon the closing of the iris was strangely pure and throbbing, almost human. As the probe lit up in dazzling colors, the note rose in pitch, climbing ever higher until it passed the range of audibility. The craft also appeared to be changing shape once again, only this time the change was far more evident. It was growing larger, rounder, with coruscating, jewel-like dimples appearing and disappearing on its surface.
"It's activating!" Rush cried, his voice breaking. "My God, it's become sentient!"
He looked hard at Nora and Tappan for a moment, and in that moment, Nora saw fear, desperation, and fury. Then he pivoted and dashed toward the entrance. For a moment, Nora thought he was running away. But then she saw he was headed toward something mounted on the hangar wall.
"Sir, wait!"
Rush's abrupt move took the guards by surprise. They seemed suddenly alarmed, more by him, almost, than by the alien craft.
"Sir!" one of them yelled. "Hold on!"
He ran to intercept the colonel.
"Not yet!"
Rush was headed for a red lever fastened to the wall inside a wire cage, a large orange warning sign above it. Reaching it, he flung the protective cage away, ripped off a striped piece of warning tape, placed a thumb briefly against a scanner, then yanked a cotter pin out from the lever's handle.
"No!"
The closest soldier reached him and tried to grab his arm, but Rush yanked out his sidearm and fired point blank into the man's face.
"Don't do it!"
the other soldier cried, hesitating as his comrade fell.
"We need to follow protocols!"
"No time!"
Rush yelled back. As the second soldier began to raise his rifle, the colonel pulled the lever. For a moment, all was silent, except for the squeal of tires and distant gunfire. Then a siren sounded, and red lights began flashing in the ceiling.
5 minutes to Omega!"
a mechanical feminine voice boomed from everywhere and nowhere, echoing crazily in the confined space.
"Evacuate now!"
A small knot of soldiers ran into the vault.
"He did it!"
the one holding his weapon yelled at them.
"He fucking pulled the lever!" "He can't do that!" one yelled back.
Not without the checklist! Don't you understand? He used the base commander's panel with an abbreviated countdown!
At this, the soldiers ran for their lives, many abandoning their weapons. Only Rush remained. The warring emotions on his face had cleared, leaving only resignation in their wake. He saw Nora and Tappan staring at him. In the background, Nora heard a sudden spike in the gunfire outside.
Ironic, isn't it? Rush said to them. You had a purpose in coming here after all. I just didn't recognize what it was. All along, at some level, I've known there was only ever one course of action. I was just too blind, or too weak, to see it.
Now, as he stood by the lever, he straightened his uniform, assumed an erect posture.
This thing was, is, too dangerous to remain intact. It must be destroyed. And now my mission is complete.
4 minutes and 40 seconds to Omega, the voice boomed. Evacuate now.
There was a beat as the three, Tappan, Nora, and the Colonel, looked at each other.
Don't forget,
Rush said, with the stoic expression of a captain going down with his ship.
Servande vitae mendacium.
More shooting in the hall, and a moment later, a jeep, torn up and ragged with bullet holes, careened into the room and slewed to a stop. Corey, at the wheel, stood up.
Get in! She cried. We're out of here!
65. Nora grabbed Tappan and shoved him into the jeep, jumping in herself as he sprawled on the back seat atop Skip and Watts. Corey dumped the transmission into reverse and then, accelerating to full speed, she grabbed the handbrake and twisted the wheel simultaneously, spinning the jeep around and then flooring it, executing a perfect reverse 180 and sending them back the way they'd come. The gravitational forces of the J-turn whipped the burnt cowboy hat from Watts's head. He clutched for it wildly, but it went spinning off behind them. Red lights flashed along the corridor, and the doomsday voice informed them in a measured cadence that there were 4 minutes to Omega. Numerous soldiers and staff were sprinting at top speed, most fleeing in a panic, but a few still firing at the jeep as it tore down the now seething corridors.
We're being chased! Watts cried.
Glancing over her shoulder, the rearview mirror was long gone, Corey could see another jeep accelerating behind them, two soldiers within. Skip raised his gun to fire, but Watts grabbed the barrel.
Not yet!
The jeep caught up and tried to ram them from behind. One of the soldiers stood up to fire his weapon, but Watts hit him with a short burst and sent him tumbling back onto the concrete.
3 minutes to Omega, came the voice, with a surreal calm.
The lone soldier driving the jeep came up on them from one side, then steered hard into the rear of their vehicle, the corridor just wide enough to allow for such a pit maneuver. Corey slowed briefly to allow her rear tires to maintain traction, then accelerated again, deftly working out of the skid. Now Watts rose, aimed, and fired down into the pursuing jeep, which veered off, hit a wall violently, then rolled in the corridor, tumbling and ricocheting like a pinball knocked from bumper to bumper. They re-entered the motor pool and, without slowing, headed toward the ramp. The portal was already wide open, exposed to the night. Everywhere, soldiers were scrambling into the assembled jeeps or running out on foot, desperate to flee. The entire far end of the hangar was ablaze, the chopper engulfed in flames. The jeep hit the ramp at full speed, suspension bottoming out, then roared up and out through the door into the fresh night breeze, catching air briefly before slamming to the ground and skidding over gravel and sand. Corey tried to put on the lights, realized, of course, they'd been shot out, but maintained full speed nevertheless, gunning it down the track and along the route they had followed so recently from the perimeter gate, weaving among the fleeing soldiers. Watts, braced, fired the automatic weapon he'd appropriated at any threatening soldiers, but most were paying them no attention in their panic to get out.
Skip fired the peacemaker with an ear-splitting roar, while Tappan, plucking the service piece from Corey's holster, shot back at soldiers foolish enough to take pot shots at them. But now, as if to ensure complete destruction, mounted weapons rose up from hidden silos in the ground, six-barrel rotary miniguns that swiveled around, seeking motion, firing at everything. Corey swerved and swerved again as the guns fired across their path, spitting thousands of rounds a minute and tearing up fleeing soldiers indiscriminately. Now, beyond the miniguns, additional munitions were appearing from hidden emplacements in the surrounding landscape, their long, evil barrels lowering from a skyward elevation to a few degrees above the surface.
"Jesus," said Tappan. "Are those 40 millimeters? Old Bofors, from the look of them," Watts yelled in return. "Probably anti-aircraft defense, retrofitted for automatic deployment." "Think they still work?" Tappan shouted. But his question was answered by the roar of the autocannons as they began pumping out shells with a hellish muzzle velocity. All around, soldiers disappeared into reddish clouds of matter as the armored shells rammed into the ground. The shockwaves and cavitations caused by the explosions almost made Corey lose control. Two jeeps were behind them, and one was pulling alongside. As it did, mini gun rounds tore through its armor like butter, throwing the vehicle sideways, where it flipped and rolled. Corey swerved again as yet another line of fire rippled past them, kicking up a 20-foot curtain of dirt, missing them by inches. And then, with the shriek of a harpy, a 40-millimeter round tore obliquely through the side of the jeep, throwing it over on two wheels. Corey, temporarily blinded as well as deafened, robotically kept her hands on the wheel and her foot pressed to the floor. A second passed before the other two wheels crashed back to earth and her vision began to return. In the glow of the firefight, she noted with horror that the passenger seat beside her and its occupant, Cecilia Toth, was missing. All that remained was a ragged circle of punctured metal where the door had been. Instinctively, Corey let up on the gas. "Keep going,"
Tappan said, leaning forward and yelling into her ear, his face covered with gore.
"She's gone."
The gate was up ahead, and it was rolling closed. Corey accelerated one more time, hit it as it was halfway shut, ripping the left section off its track and flinging it out into the dark. The front end of their vehicle sheared to one side, but with grim determination, she quickly regained control. Down the sandy arroyo, the jeep sped, fishtailing in the sand, wheels spinning, until Corey began gaining traction. The vehicle behind them hit the right half of the gate just as it closed and electrified. There was a sound like a monstrous bug zapper, and then a fountain of sparks lit up the sky like lightning. Corey continued down the arroyo, possessed with the singular purpose of getting as far from the base as possible before the main explosion. And then it happened. The night sky behind her was illuminated by a burst as bright as the sunrise, followed by a rippling series of booms that accelerated into a single gigantic roar. Glancing once again over her shoulder, Corey glimpsed a horrifying sight. The entire landscape was rising up, fragmented into a web of white and gold cracks. Brighter and brighter, a mountain of fire escalated into the night like an eruption from hell itself. And then a blast of overpressure slammed into them, knocking the vehicle sideways. The flaming debris now began to fall like bombs all around as Corey recovered and continued speeding down the arroyo, weaving and slaloming among the flaming meteors. A few terrifying minutes later, they were out of range. She brought the jeep to a halt. Everyone, exhausted beyond speech, looked back at the boiling fire mushroom in the sky, half a mile tall and climbing, shot through with purple and green, the atmosphere reverberating with the thunder of secondary explosions.
"Armageddon," murmured Skip at last.
But Corey was most shocked by the expression on Tappan's face. Tears were streaming down his cheeks, glistening in the reflected light.
"We'll never know," he said. "Now we'll never know."
66. 3 months later. The sleek Boeing 737, its only marking a red sheet line running horizontally along the windows, banked over the desert and began its final approach. The jet's configuration was unusual. It was not divided into first and coach classes, but rather had 20 rows of seats, two on each side, positioned to face each other in groups of four, with an aisle down the center. There was a single flight attendant, a young man who wordlessly brought the passengers flavored seltzer shortly after takeoff from Alamo Gordo, then disappeared. Nora sat next to Skip, with Corey by the window on the other side. Tappan sat across from Nora, beside a general who had identified himself only as Greyburn. He was dressed in field camo, two black stars embroidered on the front of his uniform. Lying curled up on the carpeted floor at Skip's feet was Mitty, the hair of his tail still singed. Somehow he had escaped the inferno at the camp, to be found later by first responders cowering in a nearby arroyo. He was the only living thing that had survived the brutal explosion. When the general had arrived at their house, with almost no advance notice, to take them on this mysterious outing, Skip had refused to leave Mitty, who he claimed was suffering from PTSD. He raised all kinds of arguments and crazy pleadings, finally getting the two-star to cave. Mitty and Skip had been inseparable since being reunited the day after the explosion, and Nora was secretly glad the dog could come along. The general had told them nothing, not even where they were going or what was to take place. It had been made clear that no questions would be answered or explanations proffered until they arrived at their destination. Nevertheless, Skip, with his vast knowledge of conspiracy theories and urban legends, recently enhanced by browsing through Noam Baton's library, was smug.
"We're on Janet," he murmured sotto voce to his sister.
"Excuse me?"
"Janet Airlines, a top-secret shuttle the Air Force uses to ferry spooks from their local airports to classified locations and back again. Apparently, it stands for Just Another Non-Existent Terminal."
He cackled.
"The only airline where the flight attendants need SSBI clearances."
Nora didn't reply. If this was true, she wondered why he wasn't just a little more nervous. A minute later, the wheels touched down on an endless runway laid out along a perfectly level salt flat.
"Welcome to Groom Lake," said the general, nodding out the window. "Otherwise known as Area 51?
Skip asked.
"I knew it."
The general merely smiled. In the seat beside her, she could almost feel Skip puff up with braggadocio. The plane taxied and came to rest. Two jeeps were waiting for them on the edge of the tarmac. The late July sun burned down from an empty sky as they climbed in and were whisked away, past row after row of hangars and giant Quonset huts, to a small, nondescript building without windows. The general, entirely silent, led them through several sets of guards and into the building, which proved to be no more than the housing for a giant freight elevator. Mitty's leash was passed off to a soldier at the entrance to await their return. "No canines allowed," was the only explanation given. Nora could hear the dog barking piteously as Skip vanished inside. They got on the elevator, its massive doors boomed shut, and they descended for a disconcerting length of time before it halted. The doors opened to reveal a vast underground hangar. Nora, for whom all this had an unpleasant feeling of déjà vu, stared in shock. There, directly before them, was the alien probe, resting on a graphite cradle.
"We are now free to talk," said the general.
"What's this?" Tappan exclaimed.
"Another one?"
The general gave a small, dry smile.
"Do you really think an object that had spent 10 million years crossing the galaxy would be so easily destroyed? We found it quite intact amid the smoking wreckage of Pershing."
Tappan almost staggered.
"Thank God! I thought we'd lost it!"
He took a step forward, then turned around,
face shining.
Have you had a chance to study it?
We have, said the general. That's why you're here. I know you've already been warned about the highly classified nature of what you experienced. I want to emphasize that warning, and to remind you it applies just as much, if not more, now.
You know I disagree with that, said Tappan. There's been far too much secrecy already. The world is ready to handle this information.
That's not your decision to make. In any case, once you hear what we've found, I think you'll agree that the world is not ready.
Can we get closer? Nora asked.
As close as you like. It's no longer dangerous.
Despite this assurance, the four approached warily. The air smelled faintly of electricity and ionization. Nora tried to remember what the probe had looked like before, because it was now clearly different, more a dumbbell shape with unequal weights on its ends. It still had the swirling, angry oval patch near the bow, but even that miniature storm seemed to have abated somewhat. The rest of its surface also looked quieter, less manic, almost as if at rest. It lazily cycled through various colors, some quite strange, before returning and beginning again.
I'll start with Atropos, said the general.
Good idea, said Tappan.
Who the hell were they? They murdered most of my team in cold blood, the bastards.
Yes, and we're very sorry for the loss.
Some of this you may have already heard from the source, so forgive me if I cover any old ground. But much of it will be as new to you as it was, regrettably, to us. Atropos was a counter-espionage organization that went awry. It had its roots in the OSS, founded by presidential order in 1942. The first OSS agents were primarily members of U.S. Army and Navy Special Forces, secretly trained in psychological warfare, sabotage, and assassination. They were billeted at the Special Training School No. 103, Camp X, set up by the British 30 miles over the Canadian border. The OSS was terminated in 1945, with several of its branches subsumed into the Strategic Services Unit, then the Central Intelligence Group, and finally the CIA in 1947. During this confused period of transition, we had an acute problem with Soviet espionage. Several scientists working on the Manhattan Project and later on the H-bomb were passing on secrets. In mid-1946, a certain zealous and patriotic officer convinced his superiors to spin off a tiny, top-secret intelligence branch, composed of hand-picked members from the old Camp X and paramilitary branches of the OSS. That, we now know, became Atropos. Its mission was simple: to protect U.S. assets against foreign espionage, with fire-free license to torture and kill spies and others as necessary. In other words, they could bypass the cumbersome and ineffective court system and take justice into their own hands. The secret Mossad execution team Kidon, the tip of the spear, was later modeled on a similar philosophy. Beginning in early 1947, small detachments of Atropos were housed at high-value targets, especially Los Alamos. Soviet infiltration of the U.S. was by then well advanced, and the Atropos units were able not only to eliminate many traitorous scientists, but also to identify, monitor, and if need be, kill Soviet sleeper agents embedded here.
You almost sound as if you approve of this, General, said Tappan.
I don't disapprove. The problem is, the unit apparently operated with unlimited funding and no accountability. That's a recipe for corruption, or perhaps worse, hubris and radicalization.
When the Roswell crash occurred, the Atropos team from Los Alamos was first at the site. Finding an alien ship with advanced technology was not only extremely interesting, but once it appeared to be hostile, that discovery ended up morphing into their raison d'être. At the cost of numerous casualties, they recovered the craft and moved it to the Pershing site. Eventually, rather than try to move it again, they built a secret base around it, dramatically expanding the underground bunker system.
What about the two bodies we found? Nora asked.
Those, as Agent Swanson here determined, were two Soviet sleeper agents, killed by Atropos. The dial-yield device was used as bait, its guts removed, and it was a prototype anyway, which is why it was of no value and buried with the bodies.
Why did Atropos just leave the bodies there?
Tappan asked.
The general gave a cynical smile.
Hubris, initially. That's an extremely remote location, and at the time they were in a hurry, and mightily distracted by having found an alien spaceship, as you might imagine. Later, they seemed to have decided the bodies were safe there, and that any attempt to remove them carried a higher risk than simply leaving them. As you know, they doused the faces and fingertips with acid to hinder identification. They didn't know, obviously, about the Soviet dental work. The two scientists who disappeared from Los Alamos in 1947 were, of course, the contacts of those murdered sleeper agents. Atropos also killed them, erased their features with acid, and buried their bodies elsewhere in the desert. We found them as well.
He went on.
As the years passed, it seems Atropos became almost a cult. They made very little progress in understanding the ship. Yet their appropriations from the government's black budget were vast, and they had spread their operatives through not only the CIA, but the FBI, the military, and, unfortunately, NASA. They were extremely adept at scrubbing any obvious signs of their existence from government bureaucracy, hiding their movements behind veils of secrecy, and keeping a minimal profile, interfacing with authorized branches enough to ensure legitimacy. The fact that they had formed so early, in addition to the continual and inevitable turnovers in government, helped. Anyway, in the absence of hard information, a lot of paranoid ideas evolved. Guarding the thing became a sort of religion, in which they continued certain rituals passed on from the earlier generation. Anyone interested in contacting beings from other planets started to look like enemies to them, because getting the attention of the alien civilization that sent this probe was, in their view, akin to inviting extinction.
Servande vitae mendacium, Tappan quoted.
Lies in service of lives, the general said.
Precisely. In any case, new inductees, poached from the special forces, were sworn in at a secret ceremony, where they would be given a blood oath and then be shown the alien ship. While the rest of the world got over its invaders from Mars phobia, their secrecy and paranoia increased. They found fewer and fewer candidates worthy of recruitment, and their numbers dwindled. That only made them more insular and unaccountable. And then you came along, Mr. Tappan, and overturned their little world.
But how did Lime infiltrate the FBI? Asked Corey. Everyone thought he was totally legit.
And he was, at least on the outside. He was a patriot in his own way, like all Atropos members, and he contributed to the success of several important FBI operations. As I intimated, numerous Atropos agents led double lives in the three-letter agencies, lives that they could slip in and out of if and when necessary.
They continued to kill espionage targets and sleeper agents, even after the two bodies at Roswell. That included the scientist so cleverly murdered at Los Alamos in the 90s. He was spying for the Chinese, actually.
How did you find all this out? Nora asked.
We captured some low-level fugitives from the base and picked up others embedded in the various agencies. The Corps Brain Trust, people like Rush, who were at the site at that time, decided to go down with the ship, so to speak. The Major General directing Atropos from Washington committed suicide. So did that Nobel scientist, Eastchester. Tragic. Clearly, there were skeletons in a great many closets. Additional information was gleaned from search warrants and extra-legal intelligence gathering in the wake of the explosion, and your own earlier debriefs. Much of the last 3 weeks has been dedicated to piecing this history of Atropos together. The fact that it operated so long, in secrecy, and with minimal interference, well, it's extremely distressing, to put it mildly.
And what about the probe? Tappan asked.
We had a great deal more success than Atropos did, although we can't really take much of the credit.
Why do you say that?
One simple reason. That little cube you unearthed was, it seems, the probe's central processor and ship's log. In effect, its artificial intelligence module. All Atropos had for 75 years was the ship, dumbly defending itself. You found the brain.
But how did it become separated from the ship? Skip asked.
It seems the probe was severely damaged roughly 10 million years ago, shortly after it was launched. When it crashed here, that cube either separated from the main craft and hid for evasive reasons, or perhaps it was ejected by the crash and became buried nearby. Atropos, as I alluded to, never went back to the site after its initial excavation. There was too much public curiosity by then. Their hope was that time would do their work for them, concealing any remaining traces of the crash. And for a great many decades, it did. But that's one reason your own dig caused them such anxiety. They couldn't be sure nothing remained behind from the 1947 extraction that might be found more easily today. The general paused. In any case, you can see the scar on the ship from that earlier damage, the oval wound in its side. Now that the cube has been reunited with the probe, however, the ship has become docile. It's no longer dangerous in protective mode.
Wound? Said Skip. You almost speak of it as if it's alive.
It's not definable as living or dead. It's a part biological, part mechanical hybrid, so advanced we can't say where the biology ends and the machine begins. Anyway, under normal circumstances, it would never have crashed. But it had been crippled in an attack. We've used a great deal of computing power the last few weeks, and enough electricity to power Phoenix in the process, to analyze it. We believe Earth was not its final destination. We were merely an accidental obstacle on its mission to carry a vital message across the galaxy, a message to others.
Vital? Tappan asked. How so?
It was one of countless such probes, launched eons ago by a now-extinct civilization on the far side of the galaxy. They all carried the same message, and they wanted to spread it to as many sentient beings as possible.
How can you know all of this? Nora asked.
From the cube. It's desperate to communicate with us. It doesn't know our language, but it can display some pretty nifty holographic, or more accurately, volumetric videos. You don't have to be a specialist to understand them. We in the intelligence community who've seen them are, well, I guess the right word would be alarmed, if not frightened.
They looked at him with varying degrees of incredulity.
There's no easy way to put it, I'm afraid. For all their cruelty and zealotry, Atropos was fundamentally right. There is an alien threat of unimaginable evil out there. Only it's not this probe, or the civilization that created it.
Who then? Nora asked.
Let's look at a video, shall we?
Greyburn spoke to an aide, who briefly worked a nearby keyboard. A flickering of light shone from a small laser tube directed at the probe. As it did so, one of the lazy, swirling patterns on its hull seemed to come to attention.
It communicates through the 550 nanometer wavelength of electromagnetic radiation. In other words, green light.
Nora watched the peculiar interaction of terrestrial laser and alien technology for a moment. And then, everyone gasped as an exquisite three-dimensional movie materialized in the air in front of them. In vivid color, visible from all angles. It showed first a star map, the POV zeroing in on a green and blue planet much like Earth. Undoubtedly the probe's home, orbiting a star. From the planet came a launching of thousands of probes, arcing out in all directions. This was followed by the materialization, or manifestation, it was too unfamiliar for Nora to fully comprehend, of something utterly bizarre. It looked at first like a cloud, a dark mist larger than the planet, a shape that was not a shape, but rather the absence of light. But the way it moved gave an indication of sentience that, for no reason she could explain, chilled her to the core. Then it did something. Something inexplicable. And the planet burst like a rotten tomato. The video went on to show a subsequent attack on the probe itself by a similar dark, cloudy entity, gigantic and hard to see. There was a cry of pain. Was it really pain from the probe? But the holograph went on to show them its evasion from the thing, hiding on the dark side of a barren asteroid while it was hunted, and then finally escaping. Next, a pullback to the galaxy as a whole, showing the probe's long, drifting path over what must have been millions of years. The solar system came into view, Earth appeared, then the crash, and darkness. Nora was awestruck. An entire history, many millions of years, had been compressed into 5 minutes and made simple enough for a child to understand. The general let a shocked silence fall over the group. Then he turned to Tappan.
So tell me, do you still think keeping this secret is a bad idea? Is the world truly ready to handle this information?
Tappan licked his lips.
No, he said at last. No, it's not. In all honesty, I'm not sure I can handle it. We're counting on you to do so. Why do you say that? Do you think I brought you all here just to satisfy your curiosity? Mr. Tappan and Dr. Kelly, I need you both, and your resources, to help us with this. In time, we'll reach out to other important and influential people as well, some who can help, and others who could, if left ignorant, inadvertently endanger our planet. I refer, of course, to SETI, and especially the more active attempts at extraterrestrial communication that are now gearing up to follow it. All that effort must be halted. And we must, as a species, find a way to shut down the vast quantity of electromagnetic radiation leaking into space from our activities.
He fell silent again. It was Nora who spoke next.
You said earlier it was delivering a message. Did you decipher it? We did. It was very short. The equivalent of one word, really.
What was that word?
The general smiled grimly. Hide.
67. Connor Digby stood just outside the closed door for a moment, squaring his shoulders and slowing his respiration. He glanced at his watch. 12 noon exactly. Ordinarily, a summons from Dr. Marcel Weingrau, president of the Santa Fe Archaeological Institute, would not trouble him. He'd been her graduate assistant at Boston University and felt he'd grown to know her rather well. In fact, normally, he'd welcome a chance to ingratiate himself further with her. But the last couple of months had been anything but normal. The department he'd headed for almost a year had begun to come apart. Two important projects, the excavation at Corn Pollen Ridge and the preparatory work near Hotactian Ranch, had gone awry in different ways. In the first, it seemed permits had not been drawn up properly, and there was an embarrassing matter about an accumulated fine. In the second, the rancher who owned the property and had given his permission for the institute to proceed had a change of mind. Apparently, one of the archaeological undergraduates working for the institute on the ranch had hit and killed a calf with his Jeep, quickly identified by its J.O. brand. Digby had done his best. He'd gone before the appropriate board regarding the corn pollen permit, and he'd compensated the ranch owner. But somehow, in both cases, he'd only managed to make things worse. On top of that, he'd heard rumors that some of the postgrads in the department were circulating a petition about him. Digby had no idea about its details, and he felt sure it had no merit. Still, he'd recently had some run-ins with lower-level staff over budgets and his efforts to weed out the tradition of slovenly attire that seemed pervasive in archaeology. Weingrau's unexpected call 10 minutes earlier had been more terse than usual. So he raised his hand to the wooden door and gave what he thought was a confident-sounding rap.
"Come in," said the familiar voice immediately.
Digby opened the door and stepped inside, and was surprised all over again. There was Dr. Weingrau, behind her large desk that seemed to exhibit fewer native artifacts by the day. But sitting in a large leather chair in front of that desk was Lucas Tappan. He looked more or less as he had when they'd first met, 4 months back, but he was more tanned now, a little thinner, and he'd ditched the hipster cowboy look for what was obviously an expensive bespoke suit.
"Connor," said Weingrau in an unexpectedly bright voice. "Thank you for coming so quickly. You remember Mr. Tappan, I'm sure."
"Of course. What a pleasure to see you again."
Digby began approaching Tappan in order to shake his hand, but the billionaire had already risen, smiled, nodded, and was taking his seat again. So instead, Digby changed tack toward a vacant chair.
"Mr. Tappan has come to us with wonderful news," Weingrau informed him. "He's planning on making a contribution to the Institute, a sizable contribution, it would seem, to endow a research chair."
"I've spoken to the executive committee already," Tappan said with another smile. "And they're on board. Forgive the pun."
"Perfectly wonderful,"
Digby said, nodding in an instinctual cadence. He was now thoroughly confused. As far as he knew, Tappan's ill-fated, ill-advised expedition, the one Dr. Kelly had been fired over, had ended in disaster, an accident with a propane tank that had killed a number of people. They had found nothing of value, naturally, proving once again that the whole Roswell thing was a hoax. If that was the case, then why was he back here now, bearing gifts? Weingrau must no doubt be wondering the same thing. Nevertheless, she was beaming to the point where he feared the makeup on her cheeks might crack off. A contribution would be welcome right now, Digby knew. In fact, it was desperately needed. Several donors the president had been counting on had recently backed out of their pledges for vague reasons, and that, combined with some poor investment choices, had left the Institute's endowment in a fragile state. Tappan intruded on his speculations.
"But there's no reason to draw this out," he said. "I'm sure you both have a lot to do."
He turned to the president.
"As I mentioned, Dr. Weingrau, I've also chosen the person to occupy that endowed chair. Someone with impeccable credentials and a distinguished career, with a long list of seminal publications. May I introduce you?
Of course, Weingraus said, clasping her hands together. In his mind's eye, Digby imagined a bag of gold coins clenched tightly between them. He shook this away. Tappan pulled out a phone, tapped it, and slipped it back into his jacket pocket.
It shouldn't be more than a moment. She's just down the hall.
She, Weingrau repeated. At that moment, the door opened, and Nora Kelly stepped in. Digby rose to his feet in surprise. This was the last person he expected to see. It took him a moment to recognize her. Instead of the usual grubby jeans and work shirt, she was wearing a pleated mid-calf dress of pale ivory, obviously expensive, and she ditched the Doc Martens for a pair of Gucci flats. Her glossy, layered hair fell to her shoulders with the kind of informality only good stylists could achieve, and her skin glowed with a radiance that had nothing to do with sitting for hours at an office desk. Oh, she said. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to knock first, then enter. One forgets.
She raised two knuckles, touched them to the door.
There.
She came forward, shook hands with Tappan, nodded at Digby, and turned to Weingrau.
Hello, Marcel. May I sit down?
This question was asked while she was already seating herself in the last empty chair.
Please, said Weingrau.
And now, said Tappan, would you care to discuss the particulars, or should I?
It would be best coming from you, don't you think? Nora told Tappan. After all, it's your money.
No, it's not. It's now, in a way, yours. The entrepreneur turned to Weingrau. As you know, the endowed chair comes with excellent compensation. But even more important, it also includes a large sum to support research, spent at the sole discretion of the chair's occupant.
Digby had never dropped a tab of LSD, or smoked a crack pipe, or even blazed up a joint. But it was clear he must have ingested something hallucinogenic, because this simply could not be happening. He glanced toward Weingrau, but her own speechlessness did little to restore his composure. Now Tappan was looking back at the president.
In other words, it's hers to spend. Care to tell them how much, Nora?
100 million.
This only prolonged the strangled silence.
Dollars?
Weingrau finally asked. The absurdity of this question took hold in the gathering silence.
Well, said Tappan with a wry smile,
we're not talking yen.
A beat. Nora looked like she might laugh, but quickly controlled herself. We're most grateful for your support, Weingrau said in a robotic voice.
Tappan added, the sum isn't just for the chair. I understand from my meeting with the executive committee that the institute is in some financial difficulties. A junk bond fund almost in default, an unwise land speculation, REITs that have declined in value. At the request of the executive committee, Nora and I have directed 30 million of our donation as unrestricted funds to shore up the general endowment. The capital improvement project, stalled for lack of funds, also needs financing. How much is that? I've forgotten.
8.5 million, Digby heard himself say.
Well, let's say 10, for the sake of round numbers.
Tappan turned from him back to Weingrau.
And Nora thought, well, we both thought, that another 10 million could be put toward increasing the salaries and research budgets of the academic staff. Again, round numbers.
He paused a moment.
And the rest, 50 million, would endow the Tappan chair. How does that sound?
Weingrau and Digby both nodded weakly.
Think about it, Tappan continued. With the endowment saved, the capital improvement project back on track, the staff motivated, and Nora in the Tappan chair, well, You could say the Institute will be transformed.
There was a pause of at least a minute while Tappan let this hang.
You could indeed.
Dr. Weingrau at last found her voice.
I expect you'll be asking for my resignation.
Not at all, Tappan said. You're welcome to stay on as president. You know, it takes a certain je ne sais quoi to scrape funds together, tickle wealthy benefactors into opening their checkbooks, things like that. You're admirably suited to the presidency. Are you amenable to that? Retaining your position, I mean.
After a moment, Weingrau said slowly,
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Tappan turned toward Digby.
There is one other matter, a slight reorganization of the hierarchy. It would involve a promotion for you.
Digby nodded obsequiously.
My people did a cost-benefit analysis of the organization and suggested a new position be created, Director of Institutional Development, reporting directly to Dr. Weingrau. You'll be able to put your not-inconsiderable social skills to work, getting the right word out to the right people about the Institute and its funding needs.
Digby thought quickly. The offer almost felt like being thrown a life preserver. With the endowment safe and the capital improvement project back on track, the title sounded important, and he might never have to get his hands dirty again on a dig, or slap mosquitoes, or sleep in a tent. He nodded vigorously.
Nora, as occupant of the Tappan chair, will assume leadership of the archaeological division in its entirety, as executive director. She will report directly to the board.
Tappan looked around.
Any questions? Thoughts?
There were none. Weingrau struggled to speak.
Again, Mr. Tappan, we're so very grateful for your generosity.
Excellent, Tappan cried. In that case, I don't want to take up more of your valuable time. It's lunchtime. Do you know, spending money always makes me hungry. With both of you at the helm, the Institute will be in great hands going forward.
Thank you.
And I know Nora must be excited about taking over as chief archaeologist and figuring out what fabulous expeditions and projects might come next, given an unlimited budget and complete control.
I confess I am at that, Nora said. Tappan and Nora rose together, said their goodbyes, and walked out of the building into the New Mexico sunshine. A minute later, they were in the parking lot, where Tappan's ice-blue Tesla was waiting.
I remember this place, Tappan said, stopping abruptly on the gravel. You called me an asshole here once.
We ought to put up a plaque. Nora looked around, squinting against the sun. But shouldn't we be going? You said spending money makes you hungry.
Oh, I'm quite hungry. Ravenous, in fact. But not for lunch.
Nora looked at him. Why, you naughty man. And she slapped his face, but very gently, and with considerable affection.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Diablo Mesa, written by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, read by Cynthia Farrell, produced by Michelle McGonigal, directed by Melanie Schmidt, recorded by Tiffany Rotash, post-production by Joe Gummery. Diablo Mesa is also available in print and as an ebook from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Splendide Mendax Incorporated and Lincoln Child. Audio production copyright 2022, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved.
Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.